Welcome to Vice and Easy, your podcast for all things Miami Vice, with your host, Marina.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vice and Easy. This week, we are again going off a different path. It's a little bit better than Cows of October, and it is inspiring me to resubscribe to different newspapers that support journalistic endeavors. As you'll see by this episode, again, we're looking at this through a 1988 lens. This episode, A Vote of Confidence, was filmed in January 1988, and you'll see a lot of timely things, maybe a inappropriate tape, maybe a affair. It's all politics, right? Let's get into it. Per IMDb, the synopsis is as follows. Miami Vice raids a train of prostitutes. Yes, that's a thing. And Johns and finds one of the candidates for governor on board with his pants down. When he disappears, Crockett and Tubbs investigate the corrupt world of local politics. First, let's see what this guy's all about. This is a wild quote.
A day when Florida will stand as a beacon of enlightenment and understanding.
Let's just leave that there. Then Crockett turns off the TV and does this whole snake oil salesman spiel. Now, remember that train full of hookers? I can't. Oh my God, I'm going to keep cracking up the whole episode. Yes, it is a thing. So they're going to go do a bust on this train full of hookers, and Zwitek is putting flares down, you know, being able to slow down the train and alert the conductor. Okay, sorry, I'm trying not to laugh. I am feeling very stuffy and it's just wanting to laugh. Zwitek also has this huge gun, and Crockett makes this wise quip that unfortunately I wasn't able to get the entire soundbite. Basically, like, you got enough firepower for those hookers. Like, yeah, you are basically slowing down a train and you're just busting hookers and Johns. So too funny. We get some good ones. We get Crockett getting a little bit spicy with one of the guys. Trudy has, it looks to be like an ice pick. It could also be like a very thin knife. It could also be an envelope opener. Shank, if you will. And she's like, you're lucky I didn't use this on you, while dressed in all leopard. One guy is giving the most stereotypical schmaltzy spiel to Gina.
To buy you. I just wanted to take you away from all this. You seem like such a nice girl.
I am a nice girl.
And how about for that?
Ooh, Crockett. Ooh. Oh my God, aren't you married? Yeah, so let's just ignore. I can't. I'm going to be laughing this whole episode. We haven't even finished the hooker train bus, so I apologize. Now, as they are going down a hallway in one of the train cars, in one of the box cars. It's a train car? Okay, thank you. You're kind of getting a little suspense when they bust in. We see a beautiful curly-haired woman in a black nightie and a very familiar face with his pants down.
By God, he's got my vote.
Oh, man. So after the intro, we are back at OCB. Gina in a quite well-tailored gray dress and her new little sheep cup that she's had the past couple episodes. It's pink with like little white sheep around the rim. She's talking about some of the Johns they met while she was on board. And basically it's like a baby diaper fetish. When two guys walk in OCB, one is familiar, one is not. Turns out that one of the deputy commissioners, I think, brought the campaign manager for Pierce, who believes this is a setup, that is a Puritan-minded setup to implicate the gubernatorial candidate, Pierce, the one who was caught with his pants around his ankles, right after talking about Florida becoming a beacon of enlightenment. However, they get lost. They are told to get lost, not only by Crockett, by Tubbs, and also by Castillo, who again doesn't want OCB, aka undercover work, to be at risk because of this. So they are shooed away, and then we are going to visit in with Pierce and his spin doctors in this next clip.
Annie will be here in a couple of hours. I'll wait for her input.
How's she holding up?
Look, this is nothing she hasn't been through before.
Okay. So he is regularly caught soliciting sexual favors. It's one thing to cheat. It's one thing to not be discreet about it, which I would assume would be closer to the agreement that they have. But let me digress on that, because let's go check in with the DA. She has a very different view on Pierce than Crockett and Tubbs do. So let's hear what they both think about this in this next clip.
Selective prosecution isn't a difficult concept to understand.
Sounds more like selective protection.
Look, detectives, Pierce may be guilty of bad judgment and questionable taste, but there was no crime committed. Find one that you can prove he committed and I'll prosecute.
Okay, well, also, selective prosecution is what the DAs do. They choose which cases to prosecute. That's what the DA's office does. So I understand her on that respect, and I see what she's saying. Very literally, there is not proof that a crime was being committed, even though he was caught in a compromising position, that might not hold up in a court of law with just him with his pants down. Yes, maybe there was intent to solicit prostitution. I don't know what the Florida laws are, especially back in 1988. So I get what she's saying, but you can also definitely tell there is a strong personal desire to keep this under wraps and to not prosecute it further. Crockett and Tubbs do bring up a good point that the women are arrested. Why not the men? I agree with that. But let's get back into it. Crockett, Tubbs, and Castillo are all talking, and Castillo tells them basically, literally, to drop it, to focus on cases that you're currently working on and to focus on what you can. After that, it kind of stings. Zwitek has something exotic to show them. When Tubbs finds photos of some middle-aged white guy, he's like, these aren't that exotic. But who that is very interesting to what's going on.
Kind of hard to find this exotic.
Well, his name's Barry Bloom. He drove Pierce to the train station last night.
So?
Well, he works for Pierce, but he's got a real shaky reputation.
Meaning?
Well, his specialty is dirty tricks.
Who told you that?
Oh, a volunteer at Pierce's headquarters. Said he's real good at screwing up a guy's campaign. The other guy's campaign, I mean.
Ooh, okay. So now that we're speaking about Bloom, let's see what he's up to now. Remember Angelica, the madam, the very pretty one with the curly hair on the train? I don't want to say who ran the train. The madam of the hooker train. They're talking. For some reason, these guys just show up to her house to talk to her, which I understand it's blocking like a play. It wouldn't work as well over the phone. But like, I like her and I like her steadfastness in what she says and what she means.
You'd like me to keep my mouth shut?
It's more of a bonus for a job well done.
Did this come directly from Miles?
Well, and me, of course.
Of course.
So we were thinking 10 grand would be nice.
No, thank you.
You want more?
I don't want anything.
Be serious. Everybody wants something.
I am serious. I said I'd help Miles Cowan because he's an old and valued friend. And frankly, Mr. Bloom, I'd rather have the future governor of Florida for me than against me.
Beauty and brains. I like that, no woman.
On second thought, Mr. Bloom, there is something I want from you.
Well, that's what I'm here for.
I want you to leave. You're quite detestable.
Now you know why I'm so good at what I do.
Right? She's just so smart, eloquent, amazing liners. I want you to leave. You're just so detestable. I also thought it was really interesting that everybody wants something. That's not untrue. But a lot of times, I do want to say that people also just want friendship connections. It is weirder to get on in life and realize that the relationships, the majority of relationships that you make with people are just monetary. You are just seen to them as a conduit for them to make money. And it is very interesting. And it is very important to hold on to those friendships. And speaking of friendships, when she was saying that Miles Cowan is an old and dear friend, I was like, I think you mean client. Or again, maybe she looks quite fancy. She has a very nice house, so she's clearly doing well for herself. Could be like an old family friend or something, kind of like a Heidi Fleiss situation where someone who grew up in upper middle class family has connections to open up her own madam. Who knows? This is years before Heidi Fleiss. This is just 1988, baby. We are getting into it. Remember the year, because it'll come up later on this episode with my little fun facts. And a very different change of scenery. Croc and Tubbs are going to restaurant bar, kind of like a beachy TGI Fridays kind of thing with a news reporter. This is our introduction to him as Stand and Deliver, no relation to the movie I'm aware of, by Mr. Mister, plays in the background.
I'd like to find out how long those legs are.
I doubt you could do anything about it, Mr.
Keep in mind, this very short, shaggy-haired man in just garb that would not, well, you shouldn't be sexually harassing your waitresses anyway. But yeah, it's just a very interesting vibe from him. But he has a lot. He has a lot of tea and he knows a lot about Pierce. And he gives Crockett and Tubbs a backstory on Pierce and how he came up in this next clip.
Pierce is smart. Made partner at Cannon McCarthy in The Speed of Light. And all the while he was becoming a political white knight. On the right side of every issue. So, why should he play referee for husbands and wives who want to boil each other in oil? Huh? He chucked it all. He made state senate, Congress, and he would have been governor if his hormones hadn't overheated.
And our news reporter Fraser just keeps going on about how power is an aphrodisiac and that how hard it is for people in that kind of line of work with that level of power to control themselves. Well, let's check in with Pierce himself. Remember, he wanted to check in with Annie, as she's been through this before conferring back with his political team. He is making a speech.
Knowing full well that there is so much to be done, that I cannot allow myself to be sidetracked by small minds who wish to derail this campaign, I will continue to be your candidate for governor of this great state.
Now, keep in mind, his wife, Annie, is right by his side, smiling brightly, their hands intertwined as he lifts up their hands above their heads to their adoring fans and constituents. So she has been through this before, and it seems like she's more than willing and happy to go through this again. Crockett and Tubbs watch the speech. Crockett again. A lot of eye rolling in this episode. He's looking good, but he looks better on later on this episode with a white sport coat, gray unbuttoned Henley shirt, while Tubbs in his double-breasted black suit, teal tie, gold watch, looking like $1 million. His earring, his diamond earring, is also extra sparkly in this episode. I will say, Pierce has such a great speech voice. That is the voice you want to hear making speeches. However, let's move on. Crockett and Tubbs are now at a hotel meeting with an older gentleman. It turns out this older gentleman was Pierce's mentor. This is, again, giving more insight into Pierce's backstory and how he came up and what he is willing to do to climb the political ladder.
First met him, he didn't know the difference between a plain brown envelope and a bag of groceries. 3 years later, he ran my last campaign for me. I didn't know it was my last until I found out Tommy had made off with all my staff. That booger Pearl Harbored me.
Caused some bad blood between you two?
What are you going to do with a fast learner? He was just following through on what I taught him.
You should have taught him to keep his zipper up.
Try and understand something, both of you. Tom Pierce is out in the edge. He likes it there.
Maybe he's lost his balance.
I just took a quick break to research where he's from and where he grew up. It doesn't say where he grew up, but it says that he was born in Detroit, Michigan, and attended Brown University. So that Kentucky Fried accent is just, I think, for show. So I've been meaning to watch Northern Exposure, and he was in Northern Exposure. So finally, maybe this will get me. The thing is like having hour-long episode series, especially back in the day with 2230, it's a large undertaking. And I do appreciate that era of TV, and that's what I want. But then sometimes when I really don't want to think, or I'm like, I just don't have the capacity to follow along with the plot, like I just want to watch 30 minutes of nothing or something simple, something short, reality. So yeah, maybe next time I get sick, I'll start watching Northern Exposure. Ooh, this also is when Crockett and Tubbs get wind to maybe look at some of his campaign contributors. Interesting. Let's keep that in mind. Tubbs proposes to see Pierce himself. Then let's check in with Annie, because Annie is basically doing a lot of work for her husband, and she wants Bloom out of the picture.
Cut the crap, Mr. Bloom. I want your resignation, and I don't want my husband knowing why you're leaving. He has enough problems without becoming paranoid about his staff.
You're dropping a stitch. He needs what I can do.
Try to understand something, Mr. Bloom. My husband and I want this very badly. There are even times when I think I covet being First Lady more than he covets the governorship.
You've always been right there behind him.
That's right. And that's why you're history.
Ooh, yeah, she does want it. Also, what perks do you really have as the First Lady of a state? I should look this up. Diplomatic immunity, maybe? Can you just run over those teenagers all you want? Oh, man. Well, let's check in. Where was Mr. Pierce? Well, Mrs. Pierce was holding court in a Lady Macbeth kind of situation. Mr. Pierce is having his makeup touched up. A reporter, Fraser, comes by, knocks on the door. Pierce is extremely handsome. Please go look at the gallery that you can find in the description notes. To look at this gentleman's eyes, my lord, that are hidden behind glasses. I was trying to figure out who he reminds me of, but he's just so, so, so handsome. And he does not want Fraser, just like always, bugging Pierce. However, Fraser words it a certain way. He says that basically he wants to interview Pierce as batting practice for when the cops come. This makes the campaign manager a little bit curious. He lets Pierce know. Pierce allows the interview. We don't see what transpires. But we cut to Prince. Oh my God, Prince. We cut to Pierce's speech.
Ourselves being subjected to the kind of microscopic personal scrutiny that only saints or children can withstand. No longer are we judged by our performance in office or on our positions on the important issues of the day. Rather, our private lives are invaded, and incidents that are nobody else's business incidents that have absolutely no bearing on our public duty become swords on which to impale us. The press dogs us all the way into our bedrooms. And while the police continue to worry about these essentially victimless crimes, real criminals of every stripe, from drug dealers to corporate executives, operate unchecked. Maybe all of this sounds like the whining of someone who has been caught and sees no way out.
A retroactive edit here. I completely buried the lead. After this speech, which for some reason I do not know why, cut off the soundbite, he says that that's why he's walking away from the political campaign. Crockett, Tubbs, the manager, campaign manager, are all shocked, and they're all asking each other if any of them knew. Remember that Crockett and Tubbs did have an interview with him. They go to Pierce's green room. It is wiped clean. Ooh, Crockett makes a little joke that politicians are never there when you need them. Now we see our reporter, Fraser, talking with another gentleman outside, and he receives a payout. Turns out it was basically to help undermine Pierce's campaign, and it was successful. This is Miles Cowan. This is the gentleman that Angelica, our madam, considers a dear close friend for whom she did the favor with. However, it seems like our reporter friend is getting a little too reckless.
Mr. Fraser, I owe it all the newspaper training.
I may have more use for the press than I ever imagined.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I'm getting a little soft in the head about politicians.
I'd like you to stay that way. Not that I mind you crucifying one of my rivals.
$10,000 in cash, as discussed.
I'll skip the count. I mean, if you can't trust the next governor.
You have my word.
My final word.
This is just for the primary, right? And there's still the regular election.
I thought you were the political expert, Mr. Fraser. If I remember correctly, you wrote that whoever won the populist primary would be a shoo-in for governor. But here I am, a survivor and a shoo-in.
Things could change.
And what?
Kind of things that could be prevented by having a reporter on your payroll.
If I didn't have my newfound respect for the Fourth Estate, I'd say that you were hinting at blackmail, Mr. Fraser.
Good enough for Pierce.
But the reporter I've had on my payroll is much too fair-minded to even consider blackmailing somebody who's been his benefactor.
You never can tell. It's difficult to know someone. I mean, really know him.
Oh, a long-winded clip. I do apologize, but just gives you... Now we're just seeing more aspects of this news reporter's character, because it's going to keep changing throughout this entire episode. Back at OCB, I skipped an audio clip of Internal Affairs grilling Crockett and Tubbs about this possibly being a setup, what have you. They're really having to fight this uphill battle. The campaign manager doesn't name him, but he references Sisyphus pushing that rock up the hill. And I was like, Crockett and Tubbs, all they did was bust a hooker train. And because the wrong person was on it, they're getting all this stuff from Internal Affairs. Like, you guys have better things to do. Sorry. I just watched the movie Internal Affairs with Richard Gere, and that was when you actually needed IA to step in, or IAD. This is not it. But let's check in with our favorite madam. Speaking of hooker trains, Angelica, she is at home. I cannot begin to compliment this robe anymore. A white silk dress robe with furry cuffs. I am obsessed with her look. In the first scene that we saw her with that white suit, again, she was looking, I guess the second scene, because the first scene was on the hooker train. The second scene, I loved her suit. I think her hair just could have used a little bit more oil. She looks like absolute perfection. There's a shot of her getting ready with the mirror, with, again, Fraser in the background. Why are these guys at her house? Like, go to a bar and have this conversation, I guess. Wouldn't her house be bugged? Okay, whatever. I digress. I'm definitely overthinking this, because we see why this takes place at her house. As they're talking, again, she is so eloquent, and she has this beautiful bottle of perfume clear, I want to say like aquamarine, but the other fixtures in her bathroom are also aquamarine and teal. So maybe that's it. Maybe it is clear. And as she's dabbing the perfume on herself, they're getting very heated in this conversation, and he takes the bottle and smashes it. However, a goof later on in the episode, you'll see that bottle, what I think is that bottle, which I can deduce is that bottle, on the sink. But let's get back to what they're arguing about.
Nerve of this bozo, huh?
Cowan?
Who the hell you think I'm talking about?
You're not talking, you're blathering.
Blather, well, try this one on for size, sweetheart. Wait, I figure it, you got plenty on Cowan.
You'll never know.
Look, neither of us are virgins, right? You have any idea how much your trick book is worth?
I don't ask them their names.
Oh, like hell you don't.
If they want to tell me, then that's fine. But I'm in the business to soothe nerves, not to put them on edge.
I really like her. I think she would have been a better counterpart to Pierce than Annie, his wife. But I digress.
Well, how about I splash you all over page one?
I think this conversation just ended.
I will tell you when it's ended.
You don't know the value of anything. Not a bottle of perfume, not even a man's life. Is this how you won all those journalism awards and blackmail? Well, let me tell you something, mister. Everybody knows what I am. But you, they think you're a star reporter. But we know that you're really just scum, don't we?
Oh, it's so hard. After this, please go out and support journalism. This guy is... This is like the worst time to have to do this episode. I was like, oh my Lord. Oh man. But yes, that was the bottle of perfume you heard being thrown in the background. And I totally kind of brushed over Crockett, Tubbs, and Bloom talking because all I could focus on was how amazing Crockett looks. Go to the gallery. He is the second image down in this ecru eggshell blazer with the undershirt on underneath gray, and has a very interesting collar too. It looks like it kind of buttons up all the way, but I think there's one button undone, so you have like a little bit of a space. With his sunglasses, arms crossed, facing down. Oh my God. That's it. That's the episode. Good night, folks. Thank you. No. But I was like, I'm not even listening to the dialogue. I'm sorry if it was like actually important to progress the plot. But we don't see what happens after they get into that tussle at Angelica's house. Now let's check in with the other woman, his wife. Annie knows her husband very well. She also knows that his self-imposed vacation is his choice, and that's not something that he normally does. However, I guess a situation of this magnitude would lead to him seeking to stay out of the spotlight for a little bit, but she is there to maintain his place.
Do you have any indication that you won't see him again?
Are you asking me if my husband took his own life?
Well, there's been some speculation.
Not his style. He loved being Tom Pierce more than anything in the world.
I need to interject here. So he cheats on his wife, trots her out to do, you know, political photos and whatnot, pieces out and doesn't tell her where he's going or invite her, just puts all this extra work on this poor woman. She doesn't get a salary as a first lady, not that I'm aware of. Maybe, again, prove me wrong. This is orator of the year, yes. Husband of the year, no. Now, as they keep talking, she starts to reveal that he got really uneasy after an interview when they ask who. She says, Fraser. They say Fraser. I've been saying Fraser. I think it's fine either way. It's spelled with a Z. So it could be either or maybe I can't admit that I've been pronouncing it incorrectly this entire time. Unfortunately, with Angelica, we find her, I hate to say this, but like beautifully staged with a milky bath and rose petals as she's strangled in the tub. It looks like the Sakura bath bomb from Lush, if I'm not mistaken, because that's exactly what it reminded me of like the rose petals and the milkiness. And when OCB is at the scene checking it out, they don't see any signs of forced entry, so they assume it was someone that she knew. When Trudy gets word by talking to the neighbors that someone matching Bloom's description was walking out of the house, which we know as the audience because we saw him washing his face in the sink with the cold water, with the perfume bottle that I just pointed out that was supposedly smashed, with her dead body just lying in the bathtub in the background. But they saw, now they have eyewitness reports about him in the area. And in 1 second later, Castillo gets a call on his phone that Bloom has been arrested.
There was Cowan's dirty tricks team. And who else was in on it?
I'm still not selling anybody out.
Avi.
You tried to protect Angelica Pace because she wound up. Stakes are a lot bigger now, Barry.
I wasn't the only one that infiltrated the Pierce campaign. There are at least three others at lower profile jobs.
We need names.
I'm not even sure who they were. Anonymity was our camouflage.
Well, okay, forget about that, because like in 1 minute or two, he names, hints at, names Frazier as a reporter who was blackmailing Cowan. And what did he need this money for? Gambling debts. And my note says how timely, because this whole Shohei Ohtani scandal going on, that seems very interesting. I made a joke about Shohei being in his Michael Jordan era. So someone posted that, like, it's going to be interesting to see Shohei try to play basketball in 6 months when he's traded to a minor league team. Ooh, well, I just hope Shohei's family is okay, because I still remember that rumor that Michael Jordan's father was killed because of Michael Jordan's gambling debts. All alleged. This was just stuff I read on the internet, but very interesting. And again, this doesn't really seem like the character we've met. And then wait till like the last act of the episode. Doesn't seem like him at all. But Croc and Tubbs go to the newspaper to go to the reporter and actually try to see him. He's not there, so they talk to his boss. Now, his boss is not surprised that he's in trouble. He talks about his debt and how he's been taking advances on his salary. But when Crockett brings up blackmail, the boss doesn't initially believe it.
So women aren't his only problem?
No, there's also gambling. I'd put gambling in first place.
How's his luck?
Lousy.
Does it affect his work?
It only affects the accounting department. I mean, he has to draw advances on his salary.
Do the advances cover?
I doubt it.
So, if we told you that we think he might have blackmailed Pierce, that wouldn't surprise you.
Yeah, it would.
Mr. Chance, every good newspaper reporter knows things about powerful people and could be used for blackmail.
But they don't use it. Frazier's the first person I know who might have done it, and that hasn't been confirmed.
And you don't believe in the law of averages?
Newspaper people are like cops. When they raise their right hand and take one step forward, it's like a vow of poverty. But they do it anyway because they love their work, and there's a small little voice inside of them telling them they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Sorry, I asked.
Women and gambling. Now, before we continue on, I'm going to bring this back to Vice T. The boss tells Crockett and Tubbs that he's currently out of town in Atlanta at the Democratic National Convention. Again, this is 1988. The Democratic National Convention, I believe, would be taking place in July from my Google research. Keep that in mind. This is January, not yet. But something big will happen at the Democratic National Convention. What is it? Ah, we will discuss that in Vice T. Now, here is some voiceover that is not Tubbs at all.
What do you think Fraser's little voice says to him? We're all the way in the eighth?
Okay, I am very confused because Crockett and Tubbs driving. With Tubbs driving, no Testarossa this episode. That is not Philip Michael Thomas. Maybe he, even though he's very famously a teetotaler, just started smoking cigarettes and that's where that came from. It doesn't sound like his cadence. It doesn't sound at all like him. I wonder, or maybe they just like rush ADR'd him and he was just like in a location where the sound was really spotty. Because that, I was like, who is that man? My apologies to that man. I do not know who that is. That's when they get a call. That call is coming from Fraser himself. Again, this is just a man with, what do they say, multitudes. Because he's not in Atlanta, apparently.
There are a couple of guys who might do it for me.
We talking boogie muscle?
Oh, you heard, huh? You know how much I owe?
I'm listening.
75 large. 75 I don't have. So they're coming over here to give me that much in medical bills.
Well, maybe you deserve to suffer.
Well, you're not coming to save me. I forget it. I don't have time to trade cheap shots.
I just want to make sure you get my story straight. Still listening.
Okay. First things first, okay? I killed Angelica Payson. I lost control. I needed what she had. She wouldn't help me.
What did you get?
Names, Crockett. I needed big names.
For what? For Cowan?
Cowan? Cowan was one of the ones I was trying to blackmail. No, for me.
What did you use against him?
He's been getting money from some of the same slugs as Pierce.
And you were blackmailing Pierce?
Yeah, you bet I was. And then the doofus decided a vanishing act was more appealing.
Okay, first a few things about this scene. Go to the gallery. You can see some interiors of the house. He has a very large, nice house. For, again, someone who I don't think makes a lot of money, seeing that he needs to advance in his salary. He has $75,000 in debt. I would like to know how he afforded this house in the first place because it's very beautifully decorated. Lots of glass blocks, especially at the entrance. There's a great gif of the two goons coming to beat the crap out of him, but you just see them behind the glass blocks. It just seems like his personality just shifted. Like, 75 large. Like, okay, were there... Again, I understand this is a one episode character and they don't need to flesh it out, but I was like, just seems very interesting. Like, this is how he goes. And that the blackmail, he was not loyal to one side or the other. He just got to pay off his gambling debts. Yeah, and there are... Especially at a newspaper of that size, there would be a lot of investigation, I'm assuming, into someone continuously advancing on their salary with known problems with gambling and women and how that could interfere with the integrity of what he's writing and what he's reporting on. But I'm going to let that rest because he is also resting in peace. As they really do beat him up and they give him more than just $75,000 in medical bills because Crockett and Tubbs just get there a little too late. And there was another clip. Do I think I have it?
Yeah, bad guys are here.
All right, Fraser, listen. You got a gun?
I'm a pacifist at heart.
I understand him being a pacifist, but if I were in debt $75,000 to people who notoriously cut off appendages and break legs, I think I would maybe have something armed, or I think I'd have a better security system for, like, what, my $2 million house? Questionable. So, again, rest in peace. He will not really be that missed. Unfortunately, because Fraser's dead, so is the case. Gina at OCB looking amazing in white and pink. Zwitek shows them the headline from today's newspaper.
appears to announce that he will resume his candidacy, quote, with a vengeance.
Down but not out.
They never are for long.
Ooh, very interesting, and definitely parallels Gary Hart, who has already been spoken about on this podcast when Donna Rice guest starred episodes ago. Now, Trudy's also looking amazing in yellow and pink. So everyone looks amazing in this scene. They want to go see Pierce. They see the DA at this party. So basically Pierce has invited them over to give them that interview that he never got to give them originally before he peaced out for 3 weeks. The DA explains things in her opinion in this next clip.
How about you, Ms. Sorelli?
Tom Pierce is the party's best candidate. I'd like to help him.
You already have, haven't you?
Things are never what they seem, Crockett. You ought to know that. You also ought to know that we play by the same rules.
What about Pierce? What rules does he play by?
The same ones as every other candidate.
Does that make it okay?
Nature of the game, guys. All these things you don't like. All these people you don't trust. Sooner or later, you gotta put all that aside and believe in someone.
Crockett basically retorts with, sell yourself short. And again, I'm trying to put this in like a 1988 mindset. So this would have been the end of Reagan, with George H.W. Bush being the Republican nominee and then Michael Dukakis being the Democratic nominee. Okay. Now, let's check in with Pierce. He doesn't even grant Crockett and Tubbs a separate interview. He just invites them to his welcome back party.
During that self-imposed solitude, I've learned many things. I've wandered the back alleys and streets of this great state, and I've gazed upon its sickened heart. And that discovery led me to one conclusion, a decision that was based upon the people's need for leadership rather than my own comparatively insignificant need for privacy. And it is with that in mind that I have returned, and I have every intention of giving this grand state of ours what it needs to attain greatness. Thank you. Thank you.
And that's how it ends. Kind of boring, not going to lie. Let's break it down. In a robe like that, she should have been the one doing the murdering, not being murdered. Angelica Payson is our best-dressed woman of the episode in that white silk robe with the fluffy sleeves. Best-dressed man, I'm going to give it to Crockett. Tubbs looked so great in that black suit. But that picture I have of Crockett's windswept hair, his sunglasses, the gray shirt with the white jacket, just looking like a million bucks. Now, Trudy in leopard with that, it looks to be an ice pick. I think it's an ice pick. At the hooker train bust, I will definitely miss being able to say that word. She is our best dressed woman runner up. And our best dressed duo, we are going back to Trudy in that blue dress with the yellow purse and the yellow earrings and the yellow compact that she's holding with Gina. A little too much color on Gina because she has the green skirt and the purple top with the coral blazer. I think one of those should have just been white and she would have been fine. Just too many bright colors all in one, but still looking amazing. Wild card. These hats, those little political campaign hats, they're so funny to see on this guy's head because his hair is so voluminous and it's just resting on top of his hair. It doesn't even fit around. They're probably just like, just some extra, like, here you go. All right, get in there. And he's like, Now, best decor, interior, naturally, it's going to be Fraser's house. I do not know how he can afford it. I personally would like to know how one can owe that much money and still maintain the mortgage on that house while making advances on your reporter salary. I know he was getting money on the side for blackmail, but how much? Now, for music, there was actually only one song, Stand and Deliver by Mr. Mister, played in the episode, but I did like some of the spookier score used in that. Now, before I get to the quote of the episode, I have some sad vice tea and some scandalous vice tea. Now, Atlanta, why was I so intent on remembering Atlanta? The Democratic National Convention that took place in Atlanta in 1988 is the infamous place where Rob Lowe got busted, where, well, he was basically robbed. He filmed himself having sex with two women, one of whom was underage. They met at a nightclub, so he presumed her to be of age if she were to be ID'd, if they were to serve alcohol. But it's only that they robbed him, because one sex tape was of them two, and then there's another tape that was released that they had taken from him and sold. I don't know if this was all the same weekend. If so, wow, Rob Lowe was really having fun. Because I was like, wait, I know there are multiple tapes. And sorry, I thought that was a fun fact. That's, I know Michael Dukakis because there was a thing on Spin City where back in the 88 election, she was campaigning for Dukakis. And I was like, oh, that's so funny. And I never really heard from Dukakis again. Again, I was 0 years old, but just thought that was interesting. A little bit of sad vice tea. So I will try to make this as least sad as possible. There wasn't a lot of tea that I could grab about the guest stars in this episode. Like, Frasier, couldn't really grab anything on him. He looked very familiar, but he's been in a lot of things. He just looks completely different now in his IMDb photo. Anthony Holland, he was the editor of the reporter who was giving them all the information. And I just really liked his cadence, the way he spoke. Unfortunately, he committed suicide after suffering from complications from AIDS. And yeah, I was just like, oh, this is quite sad. The woman who played Angelica, Shelley Hunch, let me get it right. Shelley Birch, completely wrong on both fronts. Her dad actually worked for Richard Nixon once upon a time. So it's very interesting little connections they have here. Now, with that, let's get the quote of the episode.
A day when Florida will stand as a beacon of enlightenment and understanding.
Okay. Clip number two.
Who the hell you think I'm talking about?
You're not talking. You're blathering.
And clip three.
To buy you. I just wanted to take you away from all this. You seem like such a nice girl.
I am a nice girl.
Yeah, how about that?
And the winner is...
A day when Florida will stand as a beacon of enlightenment and understanding.
Yeah, that's exactly what Florida is known for. I love Florida. But with that, we are closing up our recap of Season 4, Episode 13, Vote of Confidence. If you like what you hear, please hit subscribe. And if you love what you hear, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on all your favorite podcast platforms. And if it's not there, just let me know. You can always let me know through the episode page. You can follow me on all things social at Vice and Easy Podcast. And tune in next time. And with that, I bid you adieu, and as always...
Hey, man, Miami Vice is number one new show.